Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the on the web. It's, well, a great morning, great day. My guest, live in the studio, is Deb Kilroy. Deb, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thanks, Doug. I'm good, thanks.
Thanks for coming in. It's great to have you here. You have an amazing story to tell. And you're an inspirational woman with your journey. Now, you're a lawyer. You're an author. You've written a book a few years back. There's only the one book. You've got a few books out.
Oh, I've written your lots, story? But yeah, written lots about, you know, usually around the criminalisation and imprisonment of women and girls, targeting
but
that.
As far as a book in book form, where you got published, is just the one so far?
Oh, the biography was written by Chris Olsen.
That's right. Remember the launch of it over in the Bogger quite Road. An appropriate launch over in Bogger Road. Quite an appropriate launch. Which I attended on the night. It was great.
Yeah.
One of the few times I've been in there. You also established Sisters Inside, an organisation to support women in prison, incarcerated women.
Yep, I did.
Yeah. So you've got a great story to tell. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the north side of Brisbane, over at Kedron. So my parents were working class. You know, we weren't. Didn't have many resources, but mum was a stay-home mum and dad at that time was a bricklayer, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now you were, you wagged school and ended up in the institution, juvenile detention, was it?
Yeah, Youth Wilson Hospital was called in them days. So I was like many kids, and it's interesting when I talk to lots of people, you know, in a room and I get them to put their hand up about who's WAG school, who's truant school, and lots of people put their hands up, but it's interesting. And so then I ask the question, so who actually got locked up for WAG in school? And there's usually only me in the room that actually got sent to Wilson, which was a prison, but in them days it was run as a medical model where nurses, sisters, orderlies and psychiatrists deemed your fate, I suppose, at the end of the day. When you got released, so you weren't necessarily, in them days, sentenced to a term of imprisonment like children are now. It was for your care and protection, so, you know, or your care and control. And so I was wagging school a lot. School didn't engage my mind. I found it boring, you know, and so I'd be fidgeting a lot, or I'd be questioning the teachers. I'd be thrown out of the classroom for being annoying and asking too many questions. You know, they just didn't engage my mind. So I'd had a desk up at the principal's office, and that was boring as hell too. So, you know, myself and a few mates used to just take off and go down the valley and play pool and listen to Black Sabbath on the jukebox. We were having a good time.
What's changed? I'm sure there are kids doing it.
Yeah, they're probably not listening to Black Sabbath, but anyway, or Led Zeppelin. But yeah, you know, like, and that's where we were having fun and we were engaging, you know, doing stuff we like to do and excitement. We weren't doing anything wrong at that stage. We weren't committing any so-called crimes. We were just kids looking for something to engage us in, and the school didn't do that.
And that's a problem today. I think it still
absolutely
doesn't do that.
Yeah.
Hence this heavy-handed policies of the federal government with their attendance, their drive for a higher attendance, and it's really, there's a lot more to it than just dragging kids into school.
Well, just dragging kids into school doesn't give them an education. That's a tick and flick exercise. And, you know, and if kids don't want to stay there and go, then we're going to see the criminalisation of those children and those children's parents. And so what we see is, you know, exactly what we're seeing that's been happening in the US for some time, and that is the school-to-prison pipeline. So, you know, school just channels you into either the youth prison system or the adult prison system because you're not engaging with school. So, you know, the education system uses the carceral structures in the school environment, which actually prepares those kids to go into the prison system.
And you're not an Aboriginal woman?
No, I'm not.
So when you're asking the talks you give and stuff, and you say you ask people in the room how many put in the institution, for a young white Australian girl at 13 years old to be put in for wagging school, That's outrageous for anybody to be put in, anybody. Well, but generally, it's a black fella that's targeted.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, adults didn't make much sense to me as a kid, and they probably still don't make much sense to me these days as well. But, and it was interesting because I just got back from the Northern Territory, not last night, the night before. We took a group of young Aboriginal girls up to Katherine and to Darwin because they're part of Sisters and Sides Young Women's Aboriginal Art Group. And so I was speaking at a Women of the World festival, and I took the young women with me to experience that. And it's the first time they'd been on a plane, everything like that. But I mean, you know, it's the same situation we've got. Those kids have been in and out of juvie, or their mums have been in and out of prison, but it's about giving them that experience to actually come to something and expand their vision of the world. And all of them are now talking about where they're going to go in the world and what they're going to do. And it's really important in that sense. But I mean, the adults, like I was saying, don't make much sense, because when I was 13, what had happened was the social workers, you know, it was a newly formed juvenile aid bureau, they called it in them days, within the police. And they convinced my mum and dad, who weren't educated, they hadn't finished high school themselves, to lock me up for 4 weeks to teach me a lesson. Well, it taught me a lesson, but not the lesson that the adults in power thought they were going to teach me. But anyway, that's another story. And they'd always be telling me, you know, the adults in my life, go to school, you've got to go to school, go to school. So this day I'm dressed for school in my school uniform, and then the cops come with the social workers saying, you're coming with us. It's like, no, you tell me I've got to go to school. I'm dressed to go to school. Why don't you let me go to school? No, you're coming with us. And that's when they locked me up. And so, you know, adults are always in conflict of what they're saying and what they're doing. And we still do that as adults now, and it's not a positive role for young people, for our children to do that. We need to be consistent, respectful, treat them with dignity no matter what their age, and then we'll see positive outcomes. We need to treat children positively, not just talk about it and then punish some others. And the way that we do it in this state, in this country, is punish young Aboriginal children and young people. You know, the removal rate, as you know, Tiger, is just mind-blowing from parents, mothers tearing Aboriginal babies away from them, you know, the high rates of incarceration for young people in our youth prisons, and of course, you know, the numbers in the adult system. And Aboriginal women and Aboriginal girls are just outstripping any other prison population across this country. It's actually mind-blowing, really, you know, that they're targeted, considering when, you know, Aboriginal people make up 3% of our population in 23, 24 million. However, we've actually seen a 58.6% increase of Aboriginal women being incarcerated across the country in the last decade. And then when you look at, you know, it comes down, then it's Aboriginal men, women, and then white men. And white men only make up 3.6% of the increase of that incarceration rate. Now, you can't tell me, you know, you think about the numbers of adult Aboriginal women and you think of the numbers of adult white men, and there's way more adult white men in this country than Aboriginal women. But it's Aboriginal women who are targeted, and it's because of those racist policies, laws, structures, systems that are targeting them. And it's like Aboriginal women are not a priority in this country at all, and that distresses me.
Most certainly. When you were 13 and you were put in for 4 weeks, how long did you actually do there before they deemed you have learnt your lesson and will let you go?
Well, it was up to psychiatrists. You learn, you know, as kids, we learn things very quickly and how to manoeuvre ourselves around systems. We worked out it was up to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist then had all the power about when you got released and when you didn't. So I did get out at 4 weeks, but in their wisdom, they wouldn't let me go home to my parents. They decided I needed to go to a halfway house. Now, at home, I was actually very lucky. There was no violence in my home, physical, sexual, emotional. Like, I was very lucky that where so many other women have experienced that, you know, in their homes, and that's where most violence is perpetrated, is in our own homes, not the stranger danger that government, you know, beats their chest about all the time. But, I mean, they sent me to a halfway house, so I just took off from there because I wasn't staying there. I wanted to be at home.
You had a home and parents.
Well, that's right, you know, and so I just took off, and so as well as with some other girls, and we just ran the streets for years, and so then we were in and out because then we were committing you know, street offences, survival offences, you know, stealing, breaking into houses, all those types of things to actually to be able to eat and live. So, you know, so the system actually created this funnel for us to where we were going, which was into the adult system. And then when I was about 14, I was in there And so you'd go to court and you didn't get sentenced to a term of imprisonment as such, like a child would now. You actually got, you know, once again, the psych would make the decision. And I remember, and I was in isolation usually the whole time. The matron didn't like me and I didn't like her a hell of a lot either. But so I spent most of my time in solitary confinement. And in them days, and if you look at the Ford inquiry, you know, which has exposed all the violence in those government institutions, they, you know, I was drugged up the majority of the time. They would use, you know, chemical restraint, if you like, and keep me in isolation. And the matron made the rule that I wasn't allowed to walk on the carpet in the place either, which actually was everywhere except for isolation pretty well much. But anyway, this day that the orderlies, which are prison officers really, came in and said, the psych wants to see you. So that usually meant you're going home or he's going to say you're staying for whatever X amount of time till the next assessment. And when I went down there, he actually told me that my father had died that night quite suddenly. And so their response, because I spun out, I'm a kid, and their response, these powerful adults that are so professionally trained doing tertiary, you know, education with all their letters after their names and the matron of the place who held the most power of all over all of us, their response was to put me back in isolation and drug me up some more. And, you know, I just wanted to get out of there and get home. And but the matron came in and her wonderful wisdom again actually said over and over again, it was my fault, my father had died. You're bad, you've killed your father
you're
because of what you've done.
I'm responsible.
And, you know, when you give those messages to children, as I did, you swallow that script, that message whole. Mm. And, you know, you're bad. So what happened then, the play out of that was, well, I'll show you how bad
continue
it can get.
Yeah.
And so that was played out right up until...
Start on really being bad, not continue being bad, be bad.
Because it was like I swallowed that message whole and it became a psychological response then. Mm. Of everything I did, whether it was staying in domestic violence relationships, you know, in and out of prison, you know, whatever it was, I would put myself in some very risky places and do very risky things where my life would be threatened. And it wasn't until I was in Bogger Road after my friend was murdered in there and some time later that I came to the realization, you know, I become conscious of what I'd been doing and why I'd been doing it. And it was because I'd put myself in positions to be punished, whether physically or emotionally, more so physically, because I was being punished because I killed my father and I'm bad. So when I could unpack that and go, well, no, I didn't kill Dad and I don't need to be punished, I could actually walk away from, you know, the behaviours that I was playing out about showing society how bad I'll get. And, you know, and the scary thing is, I still go into the detention centres today and still speak to a lot of the girls and I represent a lot of the girls and you hear these officers saying the same thing, you're bad, you're no good. And, you know, and they play that out. And we just cannot keep telling children that they're bad and they're no good.
What's happening in the classrooms with kids?
Everywhere.
Right across the board.
Yeah.
So you spent time in Bogger Road. What was the longest lagging there?
The longest lagging? Probably the last one. Well, in 1988 when myself and Joe, my husband, were arrested, I was looking at a mandatory life sentence then for drug trafficking. So that was the Joe days, Joe Bielke days. They'd introduced enacted laws around the Drug Misuse Act that if you had more than 2 grams, you know, it was deemed trafficking and therefore mandatory life sentence. So that's what I was facing. But October 89, I was sentenced. They dropped that specific charge and I was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment. So I could apply for parole at the 3-year point. So... But within 2 months of being in there, you know, one of my close friends was murdered sitting right beside me, you know.
By another inmate?
Yeah, but we were attacked from behind. The prison was massively overcrowded. It was like a tinderbot. Christmas, January, you know, women, mothers aren't near their children, stressing out. Prison officers create an environment of violence and abuse. And, you know, they even knew Storm, who was convicted of the murder, stole the barbecue forks, those big long forks you use for barbecues, sharpening in her cell and knowing that she was going to attack someone and they didn't actually take. And so I got out of the hold and I was stabbed twice, hit my rib cage. I was lucky, but Debbie Storm went in a frenzy, sort of blacked out because of her previous trauma and went into a frenzy and couldn't stop just stabbing and stabbing and stabbing and stabbing and you know, I think Debbie was probably only about, I don't know, 6-7 stone ring and wet. And, you know, and then the forks were passed to someone else, the fingerprints wiped and somewhere else and they were stashed. But, I mean, we were both taken to the hospital, to the PA, and and then prison officers came to tell me that Debbie had died. So the response of that system at that time was I went back to Bogger Road. All the prison officers that were on that time or anyone else's stress took stress leave. We had nothing. We had to deal with it.
No counselling or any
support? No, none of that. Nothing. You know, because you're just prisoners.
Well, you're only crims after all.
Well, that's right, you're not deemed to be
and
treated
women,
human.
And women. Well, I mean, and women had a low place anyway.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
And so that was a very traumatic time, obviously. Mm. But, you know, prison, is a very violent place and still is. And the rule is if something happens to you, paybacks are on. And so, you know, at that time, no one really knew that women were in Bogger Road. No one really knew that women were in prison. And so it, you know, hit the headlines and stayed in the headlines and stayed in the media for quite a long time. Where what I find really distressing now is that someone can die in prison and it doesn't even hit the headlines anymore. It doesn't even hit the paper. Mm. No one actually cares. We have become a society that don't care about certain people's lives. Mm. And that's women in prison. That's Aboriginal women, Aboriginal children, Aboriginal babies, you know, like, and men in prison for that matter, you know, like no one cares anymore because we've all got this subconscious landscape now that you're a prisoner, you've committed a crime, therefore you deserve to even die in a prison system. And I think that's a really distressing, distressing where we've come to as a community.
Well,
it's
a sad measure of society.
Well, it's a sad measure. It's a sad indictment on all of us that we cannot see human beings as another human being. And that we all, you know, no matter what you do, you know, not excusing behaviours. But, I mean, you know, it's like we can think of asylum seekers as well.
Exactly.
You know, asylum. And how we as a country are treating people.
Treating them and children behind the razor wire and stuff like that.
Exactly. And not care because they come from, you know, another country.
And they're also dying as well.
That's right.
And no one cares.
Yeah, that young fella died of septicemia, for God's sake. Yes, it's 2014.
When did the last person in this country die of septicemia?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
You're right. Did you end up doing the 3 years and get parole?
I actually applied for early parole and I was one of the lucky ones and got it because my grandmother was quite frail and ill and she was looking after my youngest son. The parole board at that time gave me early parole. It was about 6 months earlier, so yeah.
Did you use your time fairly well, fairly positively? You studied in there.
Yeah, social well, when work. When I knew I was looking at mandatory life, I had a few things that I wanted to do. That was make sure my kids were placed with family and not be a threat of being taken into care like so many children are when you get a woman that goes to a mother that goes to prison. I figured instead of bucking the system like I always did, that I would use the system to my advantage, and that was to get it, you know, to get my education because I didn't finish high school. Like I was locked up. At 13, you know, they had school at the youth prison, but no one went there and did anything anyway. That was just a joke. That was a tick and flick exercise to, you know, say to the community that these children, we lock these children up and we give them an education, which is just rubbish. But anyway, I remember when I first got into prison, I went and saw the education officer and said to him, I want to, you know, do some education. He goes, oh, what's a rush? You've got plenty of time. Go away. So, you know, that was the attitude. Mm-hmm. But then after Debbie got murdered, what had happened was the old regime of management were ousted, a new regime came in and there was an education officer, a new education officer, and she was fantastic. And she went, you know, I'm lucky in that sense because the priority of the system at that time was education, education, education. It's not anymore. There's no education inside our prison system anymore at all. You can't even... you cannot do tertiary education anymore in prison.
Really?
You're allowed their new policy, which they still haven't clarified with me and I continue to ask, is one Certificate 3 level you're allowed. You may be allowed to study more if you're a youthful offender or a long term, but you have to apply. So we've got people sitting in prison for years that actually can't advance their education. And one thing that education does is actually change your view of the world and gives you choices. Mm. It gives you serious choices in society. So what we're doing is ensuring that those that are in prison don't get educated and they will come back. So the recidivism rate, and you know, that's what the prison industrial complex is about because there's so many people getting a paycheck on the backs of those inside our prison system. Yeah. You know, it's not about crime. You know, if it was about crime, because, you know, we're seeing crime rates go down but our prison rates go up. So, you know, it's not about, they don't.
It's definitely not about rehabilitation, because we just see new laws introduced in the Northern Territory, I think, where rehabilitation isn't even mentioned in this new legislation up there, from bits and pieces I've been reading.
Yeah, well, I did an interview up there when I was in Darwin just now, just gone, and the journo said to me, you know, like, do you know our minister here, I forget his name, you know, for corrections, he's actually now ensuring that everyone gets skills to get a job when they're released from prison. I said, well, why aren't they ensuring they get skills in the community and get jobs instead of being criminalised in prison? You know, we've missed the horses bolted.
The horses bolted.
And not only that, where are the jobs? Yeah. Where are the jobs? You know, like, and as you know, in the Northern Territory, there's about 90% of Aboriginal people locked up there. Where are the jobs for these Aboriginal people that go back to communities? There are no jobs. White fellas have a hold on all the jobs. They control it. So it serves a purpose. And it's all lip service. You know, if we're fair dinkum, we can actually get rid of prisons at the end of the day. We actually don't need prisons. Now, I'm not saying that some people don't need to be removed from the community, that, you know, that are violent and inflict violence on others, but we need to think differently about how we address that, not just lock people away in another violent institution that, you know, creates further violence and, you know, the revolving door.
While you were serving your time, did you do the 3 years or did you have to do longer or did you get out a bit earlier than three?
No, I got out a bit earlier than three and I was on parole. Yeah, so I did the whole 6 years in the sense and parole and finished my parole.
You did all of that.
Yeah.
And during that time, that term, during that time inside and out, you continued on with your education in pursuing a degree in social work?
Yeah, I started the social work degree when I was in prison. So that new education officer went... I wasn't allowed out of the prison to the interview with the dean at that time. So she went and did that for me to advocate, and they didn't want me there over at UQ Social Work. But she just flipped their handbook over with their values and principles and said, well, isn't social work here at this university about blah, blah, blah? And basically she had them by the short and curlies, and they had to let me in. And so I would go out from the prison, Bogger Road, to the lectures, which was an interesting process in itself. I remember going to the first lecture and I was freaking out because I'm coming out of prison, no one else. They're predominantly white, middle, upper class young people.
Were you escorted?
I was escorted.
Yeah.
And so I went there and the lecturer, it was a subject and typical uni student, you know, you're interested, or any type of student, you're interested in the assessment, really. How do I get past this, you know? How do I pass this and not fail this? And she said, you know, you had to do things like go to a court and sit in the back of the court to see how, you know, a criminal matter, you know, was processed, or domestic violence, or go to a mental health institution, or, you know, or go to an old people's home and see what it's like for elderly people who are bedridden. And she listed all this stuff, you know, that you had to go and experience. And I'm sitting there thinking, I've lived that, lived that, lived that, lived that, lived that. And so I went down to her at the end and said, oh, excuse me, I just need to ask a question. And I said to her, look, I've experienced that. I said, the only thing I haven't experienced is old woman bedridden. I probably could get there eventually. And she just said, oh, forget it, I'll give you the credit points. So my life was worth, that subject was 5 credit points in them days. So my life was worth, experience was worth 5 credit points at UQ Social Work at that time.
All right.
So, you know, well, there you go. That's what your life experience is equal to in university standards. Yeah.
When did you then decide to do law?
Well, see, the reason why I wanted to do social work is because it was the social workers who recommended as professionals, because my parents deemed them as the smartest, most powerful. So that's why they agreed to sign me away to do those 4 weeks to get assessed. And as Mum says, still today, they never received an assessment. You know, Mum said, if they would have told us to paint the house hot pink, they would have done it, because they just, you know, don't ask professionals questions. And, you know, that's why I say to everyone, no matter who you are, challenge the professionals, because they're actually not experts. You know, experts are just eggs with spurts. And, you know, at the end of the day, the stench can be horrendous. So, you know, we actually need to challenge those that are, you know, making recommendations or, you know, about what to do with our children who are a bit challenging at that time. And locking them up is not one thing that any of us should ever agree to. So I forgot your question.
You eventually went on to law.
Oh, yeah. So I wanted to do social work. So I thought, I'm going to do social work. So I play ball in their court, you know.
Right.
I got the same degree, so bring it on, you know. And then I actually didn't find, like, the social work degree really intellectually challenging in a sense, because I'd experienced so much that they were teaching about. And But anyway, I got through that, and then I thought, I want to do law now, because actually the law is a very powerful tool to have. And it was interesting, this close friend of mine, who's still one of my best mates, was a barrister at that time, and she goes, oh, Deb, I don't think you should do law. You're probably wasting your time. You'll never be admitted, you know, because you're a criminal history. And I went, oh, no, that'll just be another argument at the end of the day. Bring it on. I said, they want to talk about rehabilitation in the courts. Every day they're saying that in every courtroom across this land. Well, if I'm not rehabilitated by now, they got a knockoff saying you got to be rehabilitated, because, and name it for what it is. It's punishment. It ain't rehabilitation. Anyway, 250 pages affidavit later, you know, to the courts, and Chief Justice De Jersey was, you know, one of the presiding judges, and he had a written decision about my admission, and basically the guts of it was, you know, if I applied to become a legal practitioner in 89 when I was convicted of drug trafficking, of course the answer would be no, I was, because the test is about being a fit and proper person. But at that stage, yeah, I was, and there wasn't any challenges, and yeah, I got admitted. And there was plenty of bets going around the legal profession, yes. Whether I was going to get into it or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, which way to go?
Yeah.
What year was that when you actually, they nodded their head and
you were admitted? 2007.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's 7 years this December the 13th that I've been admitted, yeah.
Must have been a great feeling.
It was a great feeling, yeah. It was like quite surreal. It's like, yes. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Now I'm part of this
system
and it's time to challenge this system, because, you know, it's about, you know, being a lawyer, puts you in a very, very privileged position in my community, and to use those skills in a way to try and advocate to keep women and children out of prison is, you know, my priority. Sometimes that can't happen because the way the law it is, but to put the best argument forward, you know, for people that I represent is what I'm interested, because I actually know what it's like to be in prison. And so it's about fighting extra hard for those that, you know, I stand up in court for and with.
Mm. Yeah. So you're a criminal lawyer?
I do. Criminal defence work, that's what I do, I do some child protection, but that sort of goes hand in hand with the women, you know, because they're sentenced to prison, and so the department comes and takes the children, or they're in prison, and, you know, we'll do the work around child protection in that context, and also do coronial inquests, so deaths in custody. Okay. So we've just finalised the death of young Aboriginal girl who was killed that was in residential care a couple of years ago, which is horrendous. You know, there was, you know, about 60 organisations involved in her life, and she still died. 13-year-old little Aboriginal child. It was just horrendous, horrendous.
Have you met anybody else in your time that have served time and have gotten over the hurdles of becoming a lawyer?
Oh, I moved a mission on one fella, he had some serious offences, and he asked me to assist him and move his admission. I did, and I was in front of...
When you say move admission, what's that?
Oh, to become a lawyer. So you when you go through the formal process of being admitted as a lawyer, you front three judges, and they make a decision whether they admit you as a legal
professional. So he's inside, he's done the study, or he's outside?
Oh, no, he's outside. He'd been inside some years ago. He'd done a lot of work. He was working in a law firm, and he contacted me. Because they teach my case in law school. So he contacted me and asked if I would help him, and as many others have, and I do help them. And, and he asked me to move the mission. So I'm back in front of Chief Justice De Jersey, and he's probably thinking, well, I don't know if he is or not, but I'm thinking, I moved his mission, and he's probably thinking, oh, my God, I got a convicted drug trafficker moving a convicted armed robber's admission. What is happening to the law? It's like, yeah.
Wow.
And I was just speaking to another young...
And he got up?
Yeah, he got up. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So I have lots of people and lawyers and barristers who contact me to talk through the process to sit. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's about disclosure. Just be honest about who you are, what's happened in your life, you know, the offences that you've been convicted on or not convicted on. Like, I put a sort of overarching paragraph in my affidavit to say, because a lot of my children's records disappeared in the floods, they told me. And so we couldn't get the actual records to say, yes, I did X, Y, and Z as per, you know, my records. And so I put it like an overarching covering paragraph that basically said, and if you can find anything else I did, I probably did it. So, you know, it's not that I'm not disclosing. I'm happy to disclose. I just don't know about it because I don't have the documentation. Yeah. So, yeah.
While you were inside, you set up the organisation Sisters Inside?
Yeah, what had happened was one thing I firmly believe is about walking my talk and, you know, we come into this world with nothing and we go out of this world with nothing other than our word. You know, possessions come, possessions go. And I think that's where we've got it so wrong as well, you know, around capitalism and property means more than people. Because I know in my deathbed, I want my family and my friends around me. I don't want to be saying, damn, I wish I bought another car, or damn, I wish I had another Harley or another house or whatever, you know. I just can't even imagine that anyone would think like that.
Yes.
And so I don't want to be that lonely old woman with nothing because I was so interested in property.
But surrounded by your material.
That's right, because what does that give you? Nothing. You know, I want my family, friends, those that I've walked with and they've walked with me through my life journey, you know, there. Mm. And because that's what's important is those connections.
So
not
Sisters
things.
Inside being established. What was that like, establishing an organisation like that, while inside?
Well, what had happened was after Debbie got murdered and the new management regime came in, the Director General at that time, Keith Hamburger, had an idea. And so it's usually the same now. When they have an idea, they look for guinea pigs in the prison system. So it's always the women because we have less numbers. And so his idea was to set up these committees in the women's prison. So that was in Boggle Road when there was about 100 women there, right? Anyway, now we've got nearly 700, but anyway, across the state, it's just, and rising, 10 a month, with more women coming in the system. But anyway, we'd have these committees and then you'd have conveners like chair women on each, and then you'd meet with the general manager once a month to raise issues, you know. So there was committees around food, around visits, around medical. We had a street kids committee because a lot of us were kids that were on the street and we actually wanted to do something to change their lives. And I was the convener of that because I was really interested in, you know, working with young and for young people to get them out of the system or divert them away from the system in the first instance. Anyway, so George, the general manager at that time, would meet with us and, you know, we'd have these conversations. And one thing that he supported us in doing was starting to think around corners, you know, and how to bring out our negotiation skills around things. And, something simple that came up was like, for example, it's quite funny because, you know, prisons or most systems have rules that make no sense, you know, and they're sort of like the elephant that never gets moved on anyway. So, you know, there was this rule that you couldn't wear black T-shirts. And we're saying to George, well, we want to wear black T-shirts, you know, like, why can't we buy black T-shirts? And he said, well, no, because if someone tries to escape over the wall, you won't be seen. And I said, George, you seen the wall around Boggle Road? It's actually cream, whitish cream. If I'm going to jump over the wall, I wouldn't wear a black T-shirt. I'd be wearing a whitish cream shirt. And he just went, oh, my God, you're right. So then, you know, he changed the rule. We're going to buy a black T-shirt. But, I mean, you know, things like that. And they were the smaller things. But, you know, we actually pushed a lot of programs. You know, there was a number of us allowed out to go to the Outlook, which was an outdoor education program that I did the training in. You know, women were allowed to do landscaping courses. Because we didn't have an oval, no sports fields at Boggle Road, prison officers and then at that time would take us out to the Brisbane Corso to run, and they do it on their own time, you know, for exercise. So there's about 5 to 10 of us. I wasn't allowed. I was so high profile, but other women went out to do that. There was this corrections put on this cops and robbers race with the police and corrections. So they let a whole heap of people, men and women, out of the prison, and they ran from Cairns to the Gold Coast. And Joe, my husband, was in prison then, and he was allowed out because he got sentenced to 3 years. I got 6. I was too high profile. I wasn't. But, you know, we would advocate for other women to be out and doing that. And eventually I was allowed out to go and do one day volunteer at Centre Education Program down at Kingston, it was at that time, and they worked with young people who were excluded from school or caught up in the juvenile justice system, and that's where I wanted to be. And eventually when I went to the low security prison and I was eligible for work release, so you could find a job and go out of the prison and work in a job, where now you can't even do that anymore, it's just straight maximum security pretty much, I could go out every day. I'd catch a train down to Kingston, I would work 5 days a week as a youth worker, and, you know, I was employed for that. And then when I got my parole, they continued to employ me and went on from there.
Right.
But Sisters Inside, because of those committees, we had a long-termers and lifers group. So, you know, and I hope I live up to my word all the time. I imagine sometimes I don't, like we all fail. You know, it's about, I said to the women, I'll be back. And the screws would always say, yeah, you'll be back, thinking I'll be back.
Yeah, as a
back.
Cream.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, no, yeah. I'm coming back. And it's only that George and those management knew me and they would let me come back and other women would come with me from the community that hadn't been in prison. And that's where we sit and meet with the long-termers and lifers. And that's where we set up the organisation and came up with the name Sisters Inside. And we would have our management meetings inside the chapel, inside the prison once a month. And, you know, and Sisters Inside was about women, criminalised and imprisoned women. And Storm was serving a life sentence then, who killed my friend, murdered my friend. And, you know, I had to be true to myself as well. And if it's going to be all women, it has to be all women. It can't be just all women except Storm because she murdered my mate. So I had to build that bridge and fix up that relationship. So some of the women, and this is without the prison system's assistance because none of that works anyway. We did it on our own time. One of the women went down and said to Storm, oh, can you come up to sister's meeting? Well, for? Debbie wants to see you. Who's asking? Debbie? You know, because previous we tried to kill her, you know, when I was still inside. Anyway, so.
Well, she tried to kill, not only just murdered your friend, but she tried to kill you too.
Well, her mate.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what we did was she came up very hesitant.
Mm.
And I said, Storm, we need to resolve the shit between us.
Mm.
And so that took some months, some years to do that. And, you know, in the end, we were very close friends because we resolved the issues between us and, you know, and that was hard.
Mm.
And eventually I advocated, I wrote a letter to the parole board to get her out. She's out on parole now and doing really well. So, yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
Deb Kilroy is my guest, a practicing lawyer, works with established Sisters Inside, an organisation. We'll talk more about that. But, Deb, there is a conference coming up, and we won't go into it now. We'll get you back in 2 weeks. But mm-hmm. you're part of an annual conference that is organised by Sisters Inside.
Yep.
And you've always brought out, well, for a number of years, you've brought out Angela Davis, a mm-hmm. very well-known former Black Panther, civil rights
yep.
advocate and stuff, a strong woman. I met her once or twice by going over and interviewing mm-hmm. some of your mob there. You've got that coming up. That's this around the 6th of October.
8th, 9th and 10th.
8th, 9th and 10th.
In Brisbane. So, yeah.
Mm, mm.
It's going to be awesome. So if people are interested, they can check out the website. And you know, some people are saying the rego is a bit expensive, but the reason why the rego is at where it is because what happens is those that can pay, it pays for a woman or a girl with lived prison experience to come for free.
Subsidises somebody
Yeah, so
else.
We don't make yes. any – we've never made any money out of the conference. So it allows, you know, the same amount of women that have lived, you know, that experience can come and participate as well because they are the women and the girls that know what's going on and
exactly.
can expose that and people get the opportunity and that's what brings the, you know, the wealth then the beauty of the experience and the community that's, you know, that we build around the prison abolition movement.
The prison abolition movement. Your conference is titled "Are Prisons Obsolete?"
Yeah.
It's a great question to be asking because we'll talk about that in a fortnight's time. The conference and "Are Prisons Obsolete?" If we get some time today, you've certainly highlighted enough experiences and activity for people to question "Are Prisons Obsolete?" But you made a comment earlier. Now, there are people that do need to be taken out of society and placed somewhere. But in place of prisons, how would you do that?
Well, I think that's one of the things that fails us when the questions asked is, what is the other thing that we do? And it's not just one thing, you see. It's not something that you close that down and replace
exactly.
it with one thing. So, you know, if we think about... you know, what's just been exposed in the last 24 hours about young people in our youth detention systems, how it's just exploding, how the number of girls has tripled in the last 2 years, how all the girls that are locked up right now, and they're predominantly Aboriginal girls, we're talking about over 90, probably 95%, like we're talking about, you know, majority of Aboriginal girls have been sexually abused and have post-traumatic stress disorder. So imagine if we didn't respond to abuse in the way that we do, and that is when a girl or a boy, for that matter, is sexually abused and they will have behaviours, negative behaviours because of that abuse. So instead of criminalising and locking up, we actually do something to support them or prior to that, stop the abuse occurring, which is usually occurring in their own homes. And that's the issue about addressing violence against women and girls, which we still haven't got our head around about how to do that. And, of course, that's in a number of different ways. And there was just some research released this week, actually, where in Victoria. I don't know the actual number of men they spoke to, but one in five men say that if you're a woman and you've been drinking, you deserve to be raped. So this is the mindset of males in our community, which is really scary.
It's scary.
It's really scary because, you know, sexual abuse, we know 89% of women, and I think that's conservatively, have been sexually abused as well as children and usually multiple times and continue to be. And then they hit the prison gates and then they experience the trauma of state sexual assault, which is mandatory strip searching over and over and over again. And a lot of women are highly traumatised and re-triggered, if you like, for that. So they actually refuse visits with their families, which we know is one of the things that actually assists girls and women is to actually those connections with family. So if we looked at front end, you know, people call it early intervention, prevention, you know, if we had appropriate housing, but we don't, you know, if we had appropriate healthcare, but we don't, if we had appropriate education systems, but we don't, you know, it's only for those few that, well, probably the majority, but the ones that fall out are the ones that actually go through the school to the prison pipeline pretty well, you know, fundamentally, you know. So, you know, if we had a more fair and just society. We have enough resources in this country to be equitable across the board, but we don't. We have a small number of people that holds all the wealth compared to nearly a million of poor people. You know, one of those rich billionaires has enough wealth for 1 million poor Australians. So, you know, and it goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago about property has more value than people. You know, I think I remember reading one of the, you know, the richest person in our country makes something like $2.2 million interest an hour. Like, for God's sake.
How can you comprehend that sort of wealth, that sort of income?
Well, and, you know, and even if you went, well, for the next week, every hour, I'm going to give that $2.2 million to build more housing.
One hour's interest, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it is, you know, like, yeah. But they just don't do that because it's about power and control and and being a lonely old woman or man at the end of the day when you're checking out, that's what it's all about. And I feel really sorry for those people. The richer you are, the sorrier I feel because you actually do not spread your wealth in a way to alleviate, you know, those that are struggling.
And yes. Pressure and stuff, yeah.
And I feel sorry, you know. You know, they might feel good, or they think they feel good, driving around in flash cars, have the flash house on the hill and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, I feel sorry because they're really just lonely people. People will probably die alone.
Is there funding? Is there a need? Is there more money needed, or can things can changes can be achieved with the money that's on the table? Is it not a matter of? It's not. I believe it's not a matter of going to the government and saying, we need more money for this. We need more money for that. We need money for that. You got before that even starts. You rethink and plan on. And identify that things aren't working with the masses of money spent. So reconfigure where it's being spent, how it's being spent, what the programs are. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think it is a fair comment. I think, yeah, we need to.
We can make do with the money that is available for starters to get things rolling, get things some changes, some better outcomes.
Absolutely, and we need some really serious structural changes. You know, capitalism is what drives society, and that is about having more property and more things. And we actually need to move away from that because it's actually just destroying society. It's destroying our environments, you know, all those things. And we need to think about that. We need to think of our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. Yeah, I'm just thinking now about, you know, how we're destroying the Great Barrier Reef, for example. Yeah. It's just horrendous, you know.
Like, you've got to have rocks in the head.
What, for a bit of wealth today? Like, please.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, it's just crazy.
It's short-sightedness, you know, like, and yeah, it's really scary how, well, I think a lot of people don't realise it's happening because they don't have an understanding and things aren't taught to people in school about the reality. You know, like even people, kids aren't taught about Aboriginal history, for example, which is really fundamental because if we had a grasp of that as white fellas, I think it would change the view of white fellas and unpack our whiteness and our privilege, you know, which unpacks our racism, which we've been socialised to be. And that work needs to be done. And that work can't be done with Aboriginal people. It has to be done with white fellas amongst ourselves. because I find it quite abusive when I see other white fellas say to an Aboriginal woman, an Aboriginal man, oh, you know, my service, no Aboriginal people come to this. Why? You know, we're open, we're accessible, we're transparent. And they put the question back on the Aboriginal person, which is really abusive process,
yes.
Where it's actually, well, no, you're not, because if you were, had open doors, Aboriginal women and children would come in the door. So you're doing something wrong, but you need to talk to the white fellas to unpack your whiteness and privilege and not put it back on Aboriginal people for the answer for your white services or your white business or whatever it is, you know. We're the ones that have been socialised and take on the racism and the privilege and, you know, the power of whiteness. And so we are the ones that have to be responsible to unpack that within ourselves and between each other.
Mm. Reflecting back on your 7 years since you admitted to the bar, is that the
admitted
that
as a lawyer,
admitted
yeah.
as a lawyer.
Yep, yep.
Because the bar is a barrister.
Yep.
Admitted as a lawyer. How do you feel? What do you see? Do you see some changes? How do you feel? And looking at the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, how do you feel?
Oh, I feel on some days just totally despaired, and other days I feel okay about it because one thing that I always try to check myself is that I don't actually become part of the system where you're just rolling along and accepting what's happening. The despair is about, you know, how many people, particularly Aboriginal people, are charged with just offences, and they're the ones that get remanded into custody for no particular reason other than they may be a risk of breaching their bail. Well, the reality is a lot of Aboriginal people do breach their bail, and it's not because the cops can't find them or they've got a passport and they can leave the country and they have resources, millions of dollars, you know, because it's deemed then that they're being disrespectful to a court order. Now, I get that on one level, but the other level is, well, you know, Aboriginal people, well, my experience, operate very differently. They don't think, oh, I've got to be here at 9 o'clock tomorrow, especially if life's hectic and you're homeless and you forget dates and you're unwell or you may have been in the park and got bashed or raped the night before. You know, I don't think, oh, shit, that's happened to me. Quick, I better get to court because I've got to be there. Or I'm not going to go to court because I'm being disrespectful to the court. You know, that's not what people are thinking. And, you know, I was sitting in court the other day, just thought of this when you asked me the question, and there was a man in the dock, he was a white fella, and he was charged with 2 rapes of a woman. There was no objection to his bail. And then I see an Aboriginal man come in that's charged with, you know, street offences, public nuisance, obstruct, assault police, minor stuff that, you know, straight in binned on remand. You know, like we've got some unpacking to do. And the other area that I'm really concerned about is domestic violence orders, you know, like, the women's movement argued for years to have laws that stop violence against women. However, what happened is the legislators, Parliament, then enact legislation that's degendered. So the legislation used language as persons or people. They don't say women and children. Like there's an example here and there for people to get examples, but the actual law is degendered. So what happens is that then we see law enforcement putting breaches of DVOs on the man and the woman, and this happens particularly in Aboriginal communities, more so because I see so many women up north in Townsville, and I've spoken to Scylla from Naja in the Territory, and she sees the same thing. We see women, the orders are given, dual orders, and then if there's another incident, the police come in and the woman's usually charged with a reactive violent offence because she's trying to protect herself and the breach of the DVO, and they're actually remanded into custody. And we're seeing the men not charge anymore. Now, I'm not advocating for that, but, I mean, it's just how the law enforcement is enacted out and how predominantly male police are enacting this. And then we go into court and then those women are remanded into custody. They're not given bail because they may not have anywhere to go. They may not have resources to go somewhere else. They may not be able to go back to the community, or they can't articulate it to the white male lawyer that's actually advocating for them because they can't talk to them because they don't talk to white men about the issues and can't actually say, this is what happened to me. I was actually abused first and I was defending myself, you know. Usually you get the court material and the lawyer will say, okay, it says, Mary, you bashed Johnny or you assaulted Johnny. You hit him on the head with a, you know, piece of wood. Did you do that? Yep. Okay, you're guilty. Plead guilty. Instead of, you know, well, I'll say to the women up in the prison, okay, tell me what happened here. And they tell me this big, yeah, tell me the story. And then you hear this story and it's like, oh my God, it's horrendous. The violence that's been perpetrated. You know, we had young Aboriginal woman that we went to trial because, you know, she was just told to plead guilty. She came over to me and we pleaded not guilty and went to trial. and it's a risk going to trial in Cairns. But the jury came back not guilty because of the violence that was perpetrated against her for such a long time and on that night. Like, she endured hours of violence by her partner before she saw a little knife on the ground and stabbed him and hit him in the collarbone, you know, and she's one that sat in prison for 18 months before we could get to court.
Well, it's good to hear a good outcome.
Yeah.
Good to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
We're about the end of the program. I really appreciate your time and frankness and openness and honesty in the chat. But looking forward to the next one and the conference, Prisons Obsolete, and I think about a fortnight on a Thursday is a good day for you.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
2 weeks today we should be talking to you again.
Yep.
And talking about, are prisons obsolete and what are the alternatives and how can things be turned around? Yep. How can money be spent differently to stop people going in? Thanks for joining us and keep up the great work.
Thanks, Tiger. Thanks for having me.
Debbie Kilroy joining us there. Make sure you join me tomorrow. Celeste Little is my guest on your local First Nation station.